Okay, so this is Bio 231, Wednesday, October 28th. You just got done with your third test, and I was able to grade one lab section so far. I've run them all through the Scantron, but my neighborhood ran out of power last night. So I had to take the night off, and so I couldn't enter grades anyway in the computer. But the one lab section that I did grade, the grades were pretty high. There were 9 A's, 4 B's, 3 C's, and 4 D's. So that's pretty good. Okay. Huh? So yeah, it's mine this afternoon at noon. Okay, so I don't know how everybody else did, but I'll grade them and hopefully it will be similar. All right, so we're still in the central nervous system. Let's see. What's the difference between a nerve and a tract?
Nerve is in the PNS.
Nerve is in PNS. I like that. And a tract is in the central nervous system. Fantastic. All right. So what's the difference between a ganglion and a nucleus?
Ganglion is in the PNS.
Ganglion is in the PNS and the ganglion is in the central nervous system.
No, the nucleus is in the
Nucleus is in the central nervous system. Yes. All right, so what's the difference between a tract and a nucleus?
Tract
a tract is?
Axons.
Myelinated axons going someplace in the central nervous system, so it looks white. And a nucleus is just?
Cell
a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites, and they're not myelinated, so they're darker in color. Okay, so that's where we want to start. So we're going to talk about different kinds of tracts that we find in the central nervous system. All right, so don't forget what a tract is. Myelinated axons going someplace. You could think of them at some level as just a wire carrying information from one part of the brain to the other or up or down the spinal cord. So the three kinds of cerebral white matter, so we're just going to talk about white matter in the cerebrum. We've got commissural tracts, we've got association tracts, and projection tracts, or you could call them fibers if you want. Commissural tracts connect the right side of the brain to the left side of the brain. So they move from right to left. Association tracts interconnect gray areas within the same hemisphere. So maybe from one gyrus to another gyrus in the same hemisphere without ascending, descending, or moving right or left. And then the last kind of fiber are what we call projection fibers. Projection fibers carry information from inferior regions of the brain to superior regions of the brain, or the opposite, from superior to inferior. So let's take a look at some of these pictures. All right, so what we see, these lines right here represent tracts. All right, so here we see some tracts that are moving from superior regions of the cerebrum down to the inferior regions of the central nervous system. So these are what we call projection fibers. And these fibers right here, because I can recognize where they're coming from, we see right in this region right here, this is the thalamus. Here is a lateral ventricle in the brain. Here are the basal nuclei, which your book calls basal ganglia, but that's a misnomer by today's nomenclature. These are what we call basal nuclei. All right, so between the thalamus and the basal nuclei, we have this white matter right here, and it contains numerous descending tracts. All right, and so this area right here is loaded with projection fibers, but we give this area a particular name. We call that the internal capsule, and that carries primarily descending tracts between the thalamus and the basal nuclei right here. But the most important thing I want you to see that these are projection tracts because they're going from superior regions of the brain to inferior regions of the brain. As opposed to these tracts right here that are moving through the corpus callosum. Can you picture in your mind what the corpus callosum looks like in a mid-sagittal section? Yeah, okay, so these tracts are taking information from one hemisphere over to the other, right? So from the right hemisphere over to the left hemisphere. So what do we call these kinds of tracts that go from right to left? Go ahead. You probably should say it out loud. That might help recall a little bit. Commissural tracts. right? Commissural. And we're going to see some commissures. There's an anterior and posterior commissure on just off from the corpus callosum, but there's also an important commissure in the spinal cord that we're going to look at. So anytime you hear that term commissure, what should you think? Information is being shared from one side of the central nervous system to the other side of the nervous system. All right, and then the last kind of tracts that we're concerned about, which we see on this slide right here, are tracts that go from one gyrus, right, and then move over to another gyrus on the same hemisphere. They don't ascend or descend. They don't move from right or left. They just hop from one gyrus to the other. All right, and we call these association fibers because this frontal gyrus right here is associating with this gyrus that's posterior. It's sharing information. All right, so the primary sensation areas you should be aware of, like the the postcentral gyrus, or the primary visual area in the brain is the most posterior part of the occipital lobe, and then the higher order functions are what we call association areas. So primary visual cortex is right here, and then there are association tracts that take information to higher and higher levels of the brain, right, to make sense out of that information. So on this diagram right here, we can see the corpus callosum signified by these dots, because what are these fibers doing in the corpus callosum? Why are they represented just as dots? Because it's a nice transverse section of fibers that are moving right and left, right? So it just looks like a dot right there. So these are commissural fibers right here. And then these, right? And this looks like it's coming from the thalamus, maybe. This is the thalamus. Oh, here's the thalamus. This is still internal capsule. But here are fibers that are projecting to higher centers of the brain. So these are projection fibers, right? And then these are the association fibers. Okay, so those are the three kinds of fibers that I want you to know about. All right, the cerebellum. All right, do we have a picture of the cerebellum? Here's the cerebellum, inferior to the occipital lobe. Its function is, its main function is that it constantly adjusts balance and postural motions, right? So you don't have to think about maintaining balance in your body. The cerebellum has an idea of what your body should be doing at any particular time, and it's getting measurements from all the muscles in your body, and it's comparing those measurements of tension and force and angle of various joints in your body with what they should be. And if there's a difference between how much tension a muscle should be producing and actually how much tension is on a muscle, then the cerebellum is going to correct that error. All right, so it's very important in coordination. So there are little subroutines in the cerebellum or programs that you use in your everyday life, okay, like for instance picking up a pencil or walking up some stairs. And the cerebellum has learned how to do all these activities, right? It knows what kind of muscles are necessary, and it just invokes the proper muscle contraction at the proper time. All right. The next part of the central nervous system is the spinal cord. All right. Spinal cord extends from the foramen magnum down to the second lumbar vertebrae. So where the heck is the spinal cord at? Okay, so here's a good picture of the spinal cord. All right, so here we have occipital bone with the foramen magnum. And so right below the medulla as it goes through the foramen magnum, that's the spinal cord, still part of the central nervous system. And down at the very tip right here, this is about the level of L2. So the spinal cord doesn't go all the way down into the sacrum, right? It just stops. So during development, as you're growing, right, your bones grow a lot faster than your central nervous system does. And as a result, right, these lower sections of the vertebral column do not contain the spinal cord, but you can see that there are nerves. There are spinal nerves that go through the vertebral canal. All right, so this tip of the spinal cord, it kind of looks like a cone. We call that the conus medullaris. And below the conus medullaris, where we have all of these spinal nerves, that's called the cauda equina. All right, and you can also notice that the spinal nerves exit between the different vertebrae. All right, the first spinal nerve leads between the occipital bone and that first cervical vertebrae. What's the name of that first cervical vertebrae? That's the atlas. All right, so that would be nerve C1, and then between C1 and C2, then you have the second spinal nerve leaving. Right, so there are actually 8 spinal nerves leaving the vertebral column in the cervical region, and then 12 and 5, okay, in the remaining in the thoracic and lumbar division. All right, you have one extra cervical spinal nerve because of the joint between atlas and the occipital bone. We see a couple enlargements on the spinal cord. So here is a cervical enlargement. And then we have the lumbar enlargement right here. So there are more neurons in these sections of the spinal cord. So can anybody maybe think of a region why the spinal cord is thicker in this region and this region right here? What do you have? Some special things in that area of your body, namely your appendages, right? So your upper appendages, okay, are innervated from this region, the lower appendages from this region. And I believe we looked at some reflexes last time, and maybe that was even on the test. So there are just more interneurons in these areas right here for reflex activity. Okay. Oh, so on this diagram, I'll have to come back to it because I haven't talked about that yet. Oh, there's one other thing I forgot to talk about. There is a ligament that goes from the conus medullaris down to the sacrum, right? And it just puts traction on the spinal cord so it can't move through the spinal cord. We call that the phylum terminale, right? And that has to grow. That has to match the growth of the vertebral column during development, because if it doesn't, the conus medullaris actually adheres to the sacrum. And when that happens, you can imagine that the spinal cord gets stretched out as somebody's growing, and that produces some pretty severe neuronal deficits as a result of that. And so that's called a tethered cord, and then of course that has to be released surgically so that the spinal cord can develop normally. All right, so don't forget about that phylum terminale right there. Okay, let's look at a cross section of the spinal cord. All right, so this contains pretty much everything that you even have to know in lab. All right, so here's a nice transverse section of the spinal cord. You can see gray matter and white matter. All right, now why is the arrangement of gray matter and white matter in the spinal cord different than the arrangement of gray matter and white matter that you see in the cerebrum? If you were going to point to gray matter in the cerebrum for somebody, what would you point to immediately? Right on the cortex. The cerebral cortex has gray matter. All right, and the tracts are located internally in the cerebrum. But that's a different arrangement that we see here in the spinal cord. Here we see gray matter, very, very deep, and then in the superficial regions of the spinal cord, we see white matter. So these, the white matter contains tracts. Okay. In the very center of the spinal cord, we have the central canal that's filled with a fluid that we're going to talk about in just a little bit. That's called cerebrospinal fluid. Flows through the central canal all the way down to the conus medullaris. And the gray matter right here, all these nerve cell bodies and dendrites, there are 4 main parts of the gray matter that you have to know. Well, here is the gray commissure. So what's happening in the gray commissure? Information from one side of the spinal cord can be transferred to the other side, particularly for reflex activity. So for instance, if my water bottle was scorching hot, all right, and I picked it up, what would happen? Well, I would burn my fingers on my right hand, all right, so a reflex would withdraw my right hand, but other things would automatically happen too. What would happen to the rest of your body? Your left hand might push away from the table, and the rest of your body is going to react to move away from the body as well, even before you know it. So that means not just one side of my body is operating in a reflexive mode with this hot bottle, but the other side of your body is going to help get your body away from that damaging stimulus. Okay, so information has to be shared between the right and left spinal cord. All right, these projections right here are what we call horns. All right, so here is, well, let's see, this right here is the posterior, okay, part of the spinal cord. Here is the anterior, so posterior. Another name for posterior is dorsal. Another name for anterior is ventral. All right, so here is a posterior horn, and then here is the anterior horn. I'm going to tell you about the functions of these in just a little bit. And then this part right here is what we call the lateral horn. And in gray matter, we have nerve cell bodies and dendrites, right? And axons are going to project from the horns or enter these particular horns. And when signals enter or leave the spinal cord, okay, they can enter or leave through these processes sticking out of it, right? And these are what we call roots. So here is the ventral or anterior root. Here is the dorsal or posterior root. Right? And these then join together to form a spinal nerve. Now, information, what can you tell me about information in one single neuron? Can it go both ways or only one way? One way, that's right. A neuron is either afferent or efferent, right? Okay. In this area of the nerve, this is a spinal nerve because it's coming from the spinal cord, information is traveling both ways. There are both afferent and efferent nerves in this tissue right here. Afferent nerves enter the spinal cord or the central nervous system through the dorsal root. So the dorsal root is 100% sensory or 100% afferent. So that means then that the ventral root has to be 100% motor, right? If the spinal nerve is both motor and sensory, then that means that the ventral root has to be motor, 100% motor. So we would say this root right here, which is the dorsal root, is afferent. The ventral root is motor, and the spinal nerve, the proper term for spinal nerve, is mixed. It has a mixed function, both sensory and motor fibers. Not in one neuron, but because it has, what, a multitude of neurons carrying information different directions. And this is the spinal nerve right here. And it's mixed. So a nerve in the periphery is always going to be mixed. A nerve in the periphery is mixed. But a root is going to be either sensory or motor. It's never going to be mixed. All right, so how are you going to learn or memorize that this dorsal root right here is sensory and the ventral root is motor? Okay, one way to think of it is that it follows the same architecture that your brain has. So what part of the brain is motor and what part of the brain is sensory? And let's just say anterior and posterior. Okay, so in the frontal lobe, what's that responsible for? Yeah, it's not sensation. That's where the primary motor cortex is, right? In the precentral gyrus in particular. So that's motor, right? And so that follows the same architecture down here in the spinal cord. So this anterior or ventral root is motor. And where are the sensory areas in the cerebrum? They're posterior. They're like the parietal lobe, temporal lobes, occipital lobe for vision, right? So those are the sensory lobes. And so The dorsal root is sensory. Another way to realize that is what kind of neuron carries sensory information? Oh, that was on the test last time. What kind of neuron? Okay, there are actually two, but the one I'm thinking about is unipolar. Right, so unipolar, what does that unipolar neuron look like? Cell body, little projection, which then bifurcates. Right, so here's the soma. These things right here are what make up the dorsal root ganglia. Right, so thousands or tens of thousands of these nerve cell bodies of those particular neurons, right, exist right here in the dorsal root ganglia, and that's a sensory or afferent neuron, and that produces this bulge. So hence, this is what we call the dorsal root ganglia. All right, so we're going to get to these little guys at another time. So right in this area right here, we have nerve cell bodies of motor neurons that are leaving the central nervous system. Okay, and in this region right here, there are nerve cell bodies of interneurons or association neurons. And in this area right here, we have nerve cell bodies of your autonomic nervous system. And so when we get into the peripheral nervous system shortly, I'll talk a little bit more about this area right here. Okay, so don't forget, gray matter has nerve cell bodies and dendrites. Right, and this white matter has tracts. And so tracts are carrying information. There are two possible ways that tracts can carry information in the spinal cord. What are a couple different ways? It can be carrying signals up. How would you talk about signals that are moving up the spinal cord? They are afferent, or there are tracts carrying signals down, and those would be efferent, or motor tracts. All right? And generally speaking, the motor tracts are in the anterior spinal cord, and the sensory tracts are in the posterior, but that's not a really good rule. It just sort of generally holds true. All right, but nonetheless, these things right here carry tracts, and so sometimes we call these columns, and another term is called a funiculus. All right, so the white columns are made up of the posterior funiculus, the lateral funiculus, and the anterior funiculus. And these areas, what, it's just white matter tracts, sensory tracts, or motor tracts moving up or down. Okay, so that's some stuff about the spinal cord. I want you to know two tracts of all the tracts that you have in your body. The first is the spinal thalamic tract. So firstly, from the standpoint of nomenclature. So when you learned muscles, and there was a muscle on the test, okay, that you probably had never heard of before. And it was named after the origin and insertion of the muscle. So what comes first in a muscle? The origin or the insertion? The origin, right? And I think what was the name of the muscle was what? The hyoglossus muscle, I think. So the origin was the hyoid bone. Even though you probably never heard of that muscle before, you could figure out what the origin was. Okay. So here's a way to figure tracts out as well. So, again, it goes from the origin of where the signals are coming from to where the signals are ending up. So, almost like origin and insertion. So, here we have the spinal thalamic tract. So, what is the origin of these signals? The spinal cord, and where do they end up? In the thalamus. Now, where is the thalamus with respect to the spinal cord? Is it above it or below it? It's above it. So what kind of tract is the spinal thalamic tract? Is it an afferent or efferent tract? If signals are going up to the thalamus, that's an afferent tract. Right? So that's a sensory tract. As opposed to the cortical spinal tract. All right, so what is more superior, the cerebral cortex or the spinal cord? What is more superior? The cerebral cortex, and where do they end up? The spinal cord. So what kind of tract is that? Is that an afferent or efferent tract? If they start in the brain and end up in the spinal cord, that's got to be an efferent tract. right? So just by knowing nomenclature, you don't have to memorize the function of a lot of these different kinds of tracts, right? Okay. Well, let me show you where these tracts are located at. Okay, here's a spinocerebellar tract. Ah, you should be able to figure that one out. That starts in the spinal cord, ends up in the cerebellum. That's a very important motor tract. All right, but the one that we're really interested in here is the spinothalamic tract, and in particular, the lateral spinothalamic tract. Let's see how much I can get on the screen right here. All right, so here are some receptors for pain in somebody's foot, and we can stimulate these receptors with a little painful stimulus like a flame, right? You might step on something hot. All right, so the stimulus is a hot temperature. The receptor would be a thermal receptor. Then that's going to send action potentials, all right, into the central nervous system. How do those signals get into the central nervous system? Via what kind of nerve? Yeah, you could say, well, it's an afferent nerve. You could say, oh, it's a unipolar nerve right here, and it's coming in, what, the dorsal root. Here's a dorsal root ganglia. Can you see the nerve cell body right there? So that enters the spinal cord, and there's a synapse to the second neuron, and that second neuron crosses over through the gray commissure, right, enters the lateral spinal thalamic tract right here, and then ascends all the way to the thalamus. Okay, so this right here would be the second order neuron. The first order neuron is the sensory neuron. But what did we say about the thalamus? It's a relay station. So that information has to be passed on to the proper neurons that will take it to the cerebral cortex. So here is a third order neuron that takes information from the thalamus to the region of the cerebral cortex that allows you the perception of, number one, pain, all right, and it's going to be a hot sensation, and you're also going to know some other things, like what? Hopefully, you'll know what part of the body is being damaged or burned, right? So it's not just important to know that you feel a burning sensation, you also want to know where it's happening on your body, right? So, for instance, on the bottom of your left foot over here. Okay, so here is the first order sensory neuron. Here is the second neuron that forms the lateral spinal thalamic tract. And the third order neuron takes information from the thalamus to the cerebral cortex. So the lateral spinal thalamic tract is a very important pain tract. So it carries pain information. So that's something else that I want you to know. So you don't have to know anything about this tract over here, the spinocerebellar or the dorsal columns. The third order goes from the thalamus, right? So the first order is that unipolar neuron that brings information into the central nervous system. The second order neuron is a multipolar interneuron that goes from the level of the spinal cord where the information arises. Right, takes the information up to the thalamus, that's the second order. And then the third order neuron is also an interneuron. It's a multipolar neuron that takes information from the thalamus to the cerebral cortex. And when the cerebral cortex gets that electrical information, then you have the perception of that stimulus on your body, where it is, what kind of stimulus it is. Is it painful, pleasurable, if it's hot, cold, all right, or if tissue damage is taking place. And in particular, the lateral spinal thalamic tract is responsible for carrying pain information. Okay. All right, the next tract that I want you to know something about, okay, would be the cortical spinal tracts. And these are for contracting skeletal muscles. So these are voluntary tracts. All right, so what part of your brain initiates motor activity of skeletal muscles? What lobe first? Frontal lobe. Now, what gyrus of the frontal lobe? The precentral gyrus, right? So these neurons in the precentral gyrus are going to depolarize and send action potentials down a nerve fiber. And notice where does it pass right through? Between the thalamus and the basal nuclei. We call this the internal capsule right here. And it's white. Why is that white? Because I don't see any nerve cell bodies right here. It's just a myelinated axon. And it's a descending tract. So this is what kind of signal? Afferent or efferent? It's efferent. All right. It goes down through the cerebral peduncles into the medulla. And in the medulla, they cross over because the right side of your brain controls the left side of your body. And it continues to descend until it leaves the spinal cord. So let's look at this region right here. Okay, so this is the level that is going to exit the spinal cord. So here we have an interneuron, which then stimulates what we call the lower motor neuron. This right here is what we call an upper motor neuron coming from the cerebral cortex. The lower motor neuron goes from the spinal cord to the effector organ. And you can see that this is a nice multipolar neuron. Here's the cell body in, oh, what horn of the spinal cord is this right here? What horn of the spinal cord? See that cell body right there? Okay. Lateral would be like right up over here. Kind of hard to see. Okay. So this is the, yeah, so this is the ventral horn. So here we see the cell body in the ventral horn of the gray matter. And then it leaves the spinal cord through, generally, what do we call this thing and this thing right here? Those are roots. And what root is this? That's the ventral root. And what's the function of a ventral root? Afferent or efferent? It's efferent. And so here we see, right, this axon leaving that efferent root, joining the spinal nerve, and then that's going to innervate the skeletal muscle for contraction, right? So this would be the lateral corticospinal tract. And when you say corticospinal, then you should know that's an efferent tract, right? Because it starts in the cerebral cortex and it ends up in the spinal cord. So that's an efferent tract. Okay. I think we talked about reflexes already, so I'm going to skip over reflexes and move right on to the meninges. All right, the meninges are a system of membranes that surround the central nervous system, including what? The brain and the spinal cord. So your brain and spinal cord really doesn't have much in the way of connective tissue. It has some neuroglia cells that provide a little framework for the neurons, but it's not really tough, right? There are no bones. There's no other kind of connective tissue in there. And the thing that protects the brain, since the tissue is really soft, are the membrane systems around the brain that hold the brain and spinal cord in position. And that system of membranes is called the meninges. Okay, so the meninges has three different layers. So from superficial to deep, the layers are the dura mater, the middle layer is the arachnoid, and the deepest layer is the pia mater. And guess which one is the most durable? The toughest, the dura mater, and so that's why it was named that way, right? So the outer layer, and you notice that in lab. When you did your whole brains and half brains, right, it's actually really difficult to cut, especially with the scissors that we have in lab. So the dura mater is really, really tough. It's probably even tougher than shoe leather. Okay. All right, so let's find a picture of them and take a look at where they're located. And here is a really good exam figure. All right, so make sure you know this thing backwards and forwards. So here we see kind of a coronal section through the brain. And here we see white matter. Here's gray matter on the cerebral cortex, right? Which is different than the arrangement of gray and white matter in the spinal cord. And here we have part of the bones of the skull, and we see the scalp on top of that, and the periosteum is the membrane that surrounds every bone, right? So here's the periosteum, and then with the bone. And then the interior surface of this bone has a periosteum as well, But it combines with part of the meninges. So here's the meningeal part of the membrane that surrounds the brain. And it forms together with the periosteal division of the periosteum of this cranial bone right here. So these two layers form the dura mater. And this is a really, really tough layer. And then basically right below the dura mater is the arachnoid. So here's the arachnoid membrane, a little bit different. It's a lot thinner. All right. And then deep to the arachnoid, we see this space right here. And that space is filled with cerebrospinal fluid, which is our last topic for central nervous system. All right, and that completely surrounds the brain, but notice you can see in this subarachnoid space, oh, I was going to ask you, what is the name of this space? Since it's below the arachnoid, it's called the subarachnoid space. Notice the connective tissue between the arachnoid and the deepest membrane, which follows every little convolution on the surface of the cortex, right? And that's what we call the pia mater. And the pia mater is a very delicate membrane, and it has to be in order to follow the exact shape of the central nervous system. And then there are these connective tissue fibers that connect these the arachnoid with the pia mater. So the layers from deep to superficial would be what? The pia mater, the arachnoid, and the dura mater, both of these layers put together. Okay. All right. In a few places between the meningeal division of the dura mater and the periosteal division of the dura mater, we see a space, and it's filled with blood. And we call that a sinus. Right? And then this particular one, since it's right on midsection, we call that the superior sagittal sinus. All right? And these sinuses act as veins carrying blood away from the brain back to the heart so that the heart can pump it through the brain once again. So we don't have a lot of huge blood vessels and veins inside the brain because you need to have neuronal tissue in there, right? The big veins are exterior in these what we call sinuses, which are spaces between periosteal and meningeal divisions of the dura mater. All right, the other thing that we see right here is this arachnoid villus. It's a part of the arachnoid membrane. You can see it perforating through the meningeal part of the dura mater. Forms like this little fold up in here. All right, and this allows the cerebrospinal fluid that's in the subarachnoid space to actually be given up to the blood that's in the superior sagittal sinus. So this is one way that the cardiovascular system can recover the fluid that it has lost when it produces cerebrospinal fluid. All right, so that's the job of this arachnoid villus. It empties CSF, which is a clear fluid, shouldn't have any cells, and there shouldn't be white blood cells or red blood cells, but it resembles plasma, so it takes the fluid from around the brain and puts it back into the circulatory system. Okay, so that's the job of that arachnoid villus right there. All right, so that's the meninges, and the meninges surrounds the whole central nervous system, both the brain and the spinal cord. So on all the pictures of the spinal cord, you saw the meninges, but we didn't really talk about it. All right, like on this picture right here, here's the dura mater, right? The pia mater is right on the surface of the spinal cord. And then the arachnoid is right here. All right, so the fluid, the CSF, flows inferiorly through the central canal down to the tip of the spinal cord and then into the subarachnoid space and then all the way back up to the brain where there it's resorbed back into the central nervous system. Okay. So here we see another cross-section of the spinal cord. Okay, we can see the pia mater, the subarachnoid space, and the dura mater right here. And then there's room for other spaces. Right, so on top of the dura, even superficial to the dura, here is an epidural space. Right? And we see fat in there as well. And this is the space that can be used for anesthesia. So So when somebody gets an epidural, this is where anesthesia is injected, right? Usually not in this area here, but closer to this region right here. And then that anesthesia or anesthetic permeates these different layers right here, and it anesthetizes just this one particular nerve so that somebody doesn't have general anesthesia. Just one region of their body becomes anesthetized. And of course, that's a whole lot safer, especially in the condition, for instance, when during parturition, because if you had to issue general anesthesia, the mother would be anesthetized, but who else would be anesthetized? Yeah, the baby as well, right? And that could lead to pretty severe complications. Sometimes it's difficult to monitor babies in utero, and then if they crash in utero, what do? You don't have access to them, right? So epidurals really solve a lot of problems. Okay. All right, so let's look at the flow of cerebrospinal fluid. Okay, so cerebrospinal fluid is produced by a combination of ependymal cells and capillaries that we find in different ventricles of the brain. And that's called the choroid plexus. There's a choroid plexus in the lateral ventricles. There's a choroid plexus in the roof of the third ventricle. There's a choroid plexus in the roof of the fourth ventricle right there. And it's always producing cerebrospinal fluid. So that cerebrospinal fluid is going to flow because it's always being produced, right? So it flows from the lateral ventricles into the third ventricle. The third ventricle is in that space between the lobes of the thalamus. Okay, and then it flows down through the aqueduct of Sylvius, or the cerebral aqueduct, into the fourth ventricle, which is between the pons and the cerebellum. And there it can leave through a couple holes that we call apertures. A median aperture is going to be right on midline, but there are also some lateral apertures that can take CSF from the fourth ventricle into the subarachnoid space. Or the third possibility would be that the CSF travels down through the central canal all the way down to the conus medullaris before it enters the subarachnoid space. And then what does it do? It flows around the spinal cord. It ascends through all these different, through the subarachnoid space until finally it gets to an arachnoid villus, right, on the superior part of the cerebrum, and then it's returned to the circulation. So that fluid starts in the blood, it leaves through a choroid plexus, flows through the ventricular system, but it has to end back up in the blood, right, via this arachnoid villus right here. So that's pretty important. All right, so if somebody has a blockage of the cerebral aqueduct, or a blockage of the interventricular foramen, right? And that's the hole between the lateral ventricles and the third ventricle right here, then fluid is going to build up in that part of the brain, right? It's going to blow up like a balloon, and when it does, of course, it's going to push this neuronal tissue, it's going to compress the neuronal tissue and distort it, and actually it's going to distort the whole development of the individual, and that circumstance is what we call hydrocephalus, right? And hopefully that's diagnosed very early on to where we don't end up with this gross abnormality, and then that preserves the individual's neuronal tissue from, right, that severe deficit that otherwise would result. And the really nice thing about placing shunts is now there are plenty of places that can do that kind of intervention in utero before somebody's even born, which is pretty amazing, I think. Okay. All right, so we covered all this. Oh, the composition of cerebrospinal fluid. Well, it contains glucose, which is a necessary fuel to keep the neurons alive, oxygen, cells need oxygen, vitamins, and then the proper levels of various electrolytes are adjusted by the choroid plexus, like sodium and potassium and magnesium. So what's interesting about cerebrospinal fluid? Well, you produce about half a liter a day. How much is this bottle right here? You produce about this much every day. The choroid plexus, that flows through your brain, and then that has to be resorbed back into the circulatory system, because if not, you would be losing this much fluid every day, right? And day after day, could you donate this much blood? No, because you'd run out of blood. So that fluid has to be returned to the cardiovascular system. Okay. And it's made by those ependymal cells. There's just two other areas that I want to tell you about. And we see it on this picture right here. All right, so here's the superior sagittal sinus. All right, so here's the superior sagittal sinus. And right on this, what is separating the right and left cerebral hemispheres? Can anybody remember? Or are the right and left cerebral hemispheres directly connected to each other? No, the longitudinal fissure is right there, so there's a big separation between the hemispheres. And there is part of the meninges that we call the falx cerebri that is separating the cerebral hemispheres from each other. So this is it right here. Maybe you noticed that on your sheep dissection. All right, there is another part of the meninges that separates the occipital lobe from the cerebellum. But this is more horizontal, right? And we call that the tentorium cerebelli. So it just means a tent over the cerebellum. And again, there are no neurons that can penetrate the falx cerebri or the tentorium cerebelli because it's really tough connective tissue. Right? Information has to be shared by commissural tracts, for instance, through the corpus callosum. Okay. All right, so you might be wondering, well, what anchors the meninges? Right? The meninges are really nice because it prevents your brain from sloshing around inside your cranium. Well, it's attached to the crista galli. Can you remember where the crista galli is? It's part of the ethmoid bone, right? It's like that shark's fin that's sticking up, and other locations. All right, so that little ethmoid bone is doing a lot to just keep your brain in place because it's holding on to the meninges. All right, so blood flows from the superior sagittal sinus, right, into the straight sinus. All right, then there's a sigmoid sinus, and eventually it ends up back in the jugular vein, which then returns blood back to the heart. Okay, we haven't talked about circulation yet, but we'll talk about that pretty soon. Okay. All right, so I think that's it for central nervous system. So we're going to move on to chapter 14. All right, so the peripheral nervous system. How would you describe the peripheral nervous system to somebody that doesn't know much about anatomy? Where do you find the peripheral nervous system? Outside the brain and outside the spinal cord, right? All that neuronal tissue outside the brain and spinal cord is the peripheral nervous system. We can break the peripheral nervous system down into two main functional areas, and these functional areas would be afferent and efferent. Right, so afferent or sensory conduct information from the periphery into the central nervous system. And furthermore, we can break that down into two divisions. There's a somatic division, which takes signals from basically the surface of your body and muscles to the central nervous system. And the visceral division takes information from deep in body cavities. Anything within a body cavity is going to generate visceral signals, right? Okay, there's a sign-in sheet if anybody needs it. All right, so somatic means what? Things that aren't in body cavities, like on the surface, including including muscles. All right, so, and motor is broken down into those two same categories. There's somatic and visceral. Somatic means that these are signals that are going to innervate the more superficial regions of your body, mainly skeletal muscle. And what kind of control is skeletal muscle under? Voluntary control. So sometimes somatic and voluntary are used as synonyms for each other. That's not always perfect, but that works generally pretty well. Visceral motor, on the other hand, goes to tissues that are in body cavities, like your heart and lungs, digestive tract, right, reproductive tract. So the effector organs for your somatic motor system would be skeletal muscle. Effector organs for visceral or autonomic, that's another term, autonomic, would be cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, and glands. Those are the three effector organs. All right, in terms of a structural organization, right, we have peripheral receptors on the surface of our body. We have peripheral motor endings like neuromuscular junctions. And then we have various nerves that take information from the CNS to these effector organs. And there are two regions that nerves can leave the central nervous system. Nerves can leave via the brain, and we call those cranial nerves. Or nerves can leave via the spinal cord, the only two parts of the central nervous system, and so we call those spinal nerves. Okay. In terms of peripheral sensory receptors, all right, we have free nerve endings, or we have specialized receptor cells. And maybe you can remember some of these from the integumentary chapter, but free nerve endings allow us to feel temperature. So there are nerve endings responsible for cold. There's free nerve endings for heat, all right? And then there's free nerve endings for pain. When they become damaged, you feel pain. And then there are other special kinds of receptor cells for vibration. There's deep vibration. There's light touch, like Pacinian corpuscles and such. Okay. Another way that we can classify receptors is by location. Some receptors are near the surface of the body, for instance, for touch, pressure, pain, and temperature. Right? They're sensitive to stimuli that's outside the body, but the internal environment of your body is always being monitored for pH, right? For pain of organs inside body cavities, right? If they become infected, for instance. And those are what we call interoceptors. Interoceptors measure concentrations of, say, oxygen and CO2 and hydrogen ions, which is the basis for pH. They can also measure stretching and temperature inside the body. These are all examples of interoceptors, right? So they don't respond to external stimuli, they respond to internal stimuli. And then the last kind of receptor is what we call a proprioceptor. This is kind of a strange one. Proprioceptors we have in all muscles, right, and joints, and tendons and ligaments. And proprioceptors measure the amount of stretch and tension that is being generated by muscles and tendons, ligaments of the musculoskeletal system. So proprioceptors tell you what position your body is in and if it's behaving properly. Right? And so proprioceptors share information most directly with the cerebellum, which is always looking out, making sure that your body is in the right position. Another way that we can classify receptors is by the kind of energy that they are sensitive to. So there are mechanoreceptors that respond to mechanical events in and around our body, like touch and pressure, vibration, and even sound is a mechanical wave. So when you hear stuff, that's a result of a mechanoreceptor that's in your ear. We have thermoreceptors on our skin. We even have a thermoreceptor in our hypothalamus that is monitoring our body temperature all the time. So some of the thermoreceptors are exteroceptors and others are interoceptors. And then we have chemoreceptors, have, some are intro, some are extro receptors. We have chemoreceptors on our tongue. We have chemoreceptors in our nose. Those would be extro receptors. But we also have chemoreceptors in our pancreas that are monitoring our blood glucose levels. That would be an example of an interoceptor. All right, photoreceptors. Where do you have these at? They measure photons. What's a photon? I know it's a weapon on Star Trek, but what else is it? It's light. All right, so your eyes have photoreceptors, and nociceptors are just receptors that can monitor noxious kinds of stimuli, like strong acids and bases. If you breathe a strong acid in your nose, all right, or what's a good way when somebody is kind of woozy, passing out? What's a way to kind of wake them back up? They snap a little ampule of ammonia, which is a very strong base, and somebody breathes some a little bit of ammonia in your nose, and it stimulates these nociceptors, and that kind of wakes you up temporarily. All right, so any kind of noxious stimuli are picked up, including pain, by nociceptors. All right, so we can also classify receptors by structure. All right, encapsulated would be like the Meissner's corpuscle, the Pacinian corpuscle, and Ruffini's corpuscle. Meissner's corpuscle is very superficial in the integument, so that responds very well to light pressure. All right, the Pacinian corpuscle is down in the dermis, so that means that it's going to respond to deeper kind of pressure. All right, and Ruffini's corpuscle is relatively deep as well, so it responds to deep pressure and stretch. And then the non-encapsulated would be the free nerve endings. And you have free nerve endings around hair follicles. So when a hair follicle is stimulated, you can feel like a breeze over the surface of your skin. And Merkel's discs are just modified free nerve endings for very, very light pressure. Proprioceptors, we said, are in muscles and tendons and ligaments, as well as joint capsules. And these all respond to various degrees of stretch, primarily. Okay. So let's see. I think we looked at a neuromuscular junction already in here. Okay, so here is a picture of a neuromuscular junction. And a neuromuscular junction is a junction between this motor neuron and this effector organ. All right, and so this is a somatic motor neuron. So what would this effector organ be right here if this is a somatic motor neuron? As a matter of fact, you could just label this somatic motor neuron. Somatic means, it means voluntary. What kind of effector organ is under voluntary control? Skeletal muscle, right? So this is the neuromuscular junction, all right? And so this is a synapse. And what the heck is a synapse? What the heck is a synapse? Yeah, it's a structural and functional unit of communication between two cells, right? And there's two kinds of synapses. What are the two kinds? You got chemical and electrical. And this one right here requires neurotransmitters that are stored in these synaptic vesicles, right? And that neurotransmitter has to diffuse across the synaptic cleft to stimulate the muscle cell. So what kind of synapse is this, electrical or chemical? That's a chemical synapse, right? So any kind of synapse that requires a neurotransmitter is a chemical synapse. So when an electrical signal reaches the end of the axon or the axon terminus, sometimes we call this a terminal button. Sometimes we call it a bouton terminale. It's got all kinds of different names. That electrical signal causes calcium to enter, and that calcium is a signal for a bunch of machinery inside this terminal button to take a synaptic vesicle, move it over to the presynaptic membrane, have it fused to the presynaptic membrane so that neurotransmitter is released into the synaptic cleft. And then the neurotransmitter, let's really zoom in right here, then the neurotransmitter diffuses and will bind to special receptors in the postsynaptic membrane. And then another electrical signal is generated on the surface of the muscle cell, and that electrical signal travels over the whole muscle cell. And that's what causes these actin and myosin to slide over each other. Okay, so that's the neuromuscular junction. Okay, so that takes us to nerves that enter your periphery from your brain. And these are what we call cranial nerves. And there happen to be 12 cranial nerves. And they're categorized into four different kinds, depending on which way traffic moves. So if information only enters the central nervous system via cranial nerve, right? What kind of nerve is bringing information into the central nervous system? It is, I'll give you three choices. It's either afferent, efferent, or mixed. Those are the three choices. So if it's bringing information from the periphery into the central nervous system, it's got to be afferent. Okay? So some cranial nerves are 100% sensory or afferent, right? And these are for vision. Okay, cranial nerves number 1, 2, and 8. All right, so vision is important. Smell, I don't have that on here. Smell, okay, touch and pain via cranial nerve number 8. All right, some are efferent, namely somatic motor. These go to skeletal muscles. These are cranial nerves 3, 4, 6, 11, and 12. All right, and I'll show you an easy way to memorize this stuff. All right. Some are what we call parasympathetic motor. It's part of your autonomic nervous system. These are cranial nerves 3, 7, 9, and 10. And in particular, if I was going to pick one for you to remember, I would pick number 10. Right there. Okay. And then some are mixed. What does mixed mean? They have some axons carrying information out. They have other axons carrying information into the central nervous system. Right? And so that's going to be 5, 7, 9, and 10. All right? Are mixed. And so a good way to remember the names of the cranial nerves, right? Well, I'll tell you what. Let's just take a look at some cranial nerves first. So this might be an exam figure right here. And you probably know a lot of this stuff already from lab. So, for instance, what part of the brain is right down over here? That's the cerebellum. So this is posterior and inferior. And over here is the frontal lobe, right? So that's very anterior. So this is a nice diagram that you can see things from anterior to posterior on the ventral part of the brain. And cranial nerves come from the brain and the brain stem, and they're numbered starting with number 1, the most anterior, and then number 12 is the most posterior. All right, so you can just count down. Here's cranial nerve number 1, number 2, number 3, number 4, number 5, as you go from anterior to posterior. So generally speaking, it's not too difficult, all right, to see cranial nerves by number if you just know how they're numbered. They're just numbered from anterior to posterior. Okay. Now here is something that's a little bit more difficult, and that is, how do you know the names of the cranial nerves? One easy way for some of them is the most anterior nerve right here, right, corresponds to the most anterior sense organ that you have on your face, which is your... What's the most anterior sense organ you have on your face? Yeah, you're all kind of scratching. That's your nose. All right, so what's the sense of smell really called? That is, olfactory sense, or the sense of olfaction. All right, so the cranial nerve number 1 is what we call the olfactory nerve. So here is the olfactory bulb that sends olfactory nerve down into your nasal cavity so that you can perceive odorant molecules. then these send signals to the brain via this olfactory tract. All right, so the olfactory nerves right here are in the peripheral nervous system, but this tract is really now with inside the dura mater, so this is really part of the central nervous system, but nonetheless, right, this is still coming from cranial nerve number one, olfactory nerve. All right, what's another sense organ that you have very anterior on your face? Your eyes. Not as anterior as your nose, but almost. Right, so here is the optic nerve. And the optic nerve, well, just like the olfactory nerve, is sensory, purely sensory. So that's bringing what? Information of vision into your central nervous system. So this one is coming from your left eyeball. This one's coming from your right eyeball. And just like the motor system that we looked at, where signals cross over from one side of the central nervous system to the other, the sensory information does the same thing. It crosses over. It decussates from one side to the other. And where these nerves cross over each other, right here in the center, that's what we call the optic chiasma. So here's the optic chiasma, and that's right at the level of the meninges. So those same fibers now enter the central nervous system, so this is what we call the optic tract, if it's inside the central nervous system. So we got optic nerve, optic chiasma, and optic tract right here. Okay, oculomotor nerve, that's for controlling eye muscles. All right, trochlear nerve, number four, trigeminal. All right, number six, abducens. I do want to talk about this one because it's not too difficult to appreciate what this one does. All right, cranial nerve number six. All right, so what does abduction mean? Ah, see, this is every test is cumulative in here, sort of. Abduction is what? Do abduction with your humerus, for instance. What is that? No, that's close. It's what? Moving away from midline. Okay, abduction is moving away from midline. And this controls, okay, a muscle that goes to your eye, right? And it's going to be a lateral muscle because when that muscle gets stimulated, what does your eyeball do? It abducts. Okay, now you can't abduct both at the same time. Okay, you can learn how to do that, I suppose. But generally speaking, you only abduct one eyeball at a time. But don't try it because what did your mother tell you? They could get stuck that way, but it doesn't really work, but everybody's mother tells you that. Okay, so the abducens contracts the lateral rectus muscle that abducts the eye. Okay, well let's talk about some more about nomenclature. All right, so here is each of the cranial nerves, 1 through 12. Here is the name, all right, and you got to become familiar with this. Here and in your book, it gives all kinds of different functions for cranial nerves. So here's a simplified list. All right. So number one for smell, number two for vision, oculomotor, we'll just say pupil constriction when it's really, really bright out, that's going to constrict your pupil. Trochlea controls a bunch of other eye muscles, right, for moving your eyeball around. Trigeminal is sensory to your face. So, for instance, when you go visit a dentist and you have anesthesia, they inject some drugs into a nerve that numbs a part of your face. Guess what nerve is being anesthetized? It's that trigeminal nerve. Okay, abducens we just talked about. That's eye muscle. Facial is for taste. All right. All right, so you can read the rest of these right here. Maybe I'll get back to it in a little bit. All right, but I want you to be able to tell me, if I give you the number of a cranial nerve, what the name is. So how on earth are you going to do that? Okay? It's by using a mnemonic. All right? So a mnemonic is a little saying, a little quip. It could be a poem or a sentence or something that's easy to remember. And the first letter of every word in the mnemonic corresponds to the first letter of a list that's really hard to memorize. All right, so that's a mnemonic. So the mnemonic that I used, that I liked a lot, is this. It says, on old Olympus's towering top, a Finn and German viewed a hop. Okay, and some of you can't relate to that very well, but what can you tell me about a hop? What's a hop? It's not a dance. It's a grain, right, that's used to make beer, for instance, right? Or adult beverage, better yet, we can say that. And I guess Finns and Germans like to admire their farming and drink beer and things like that. Okay, and Olympus is a mountain that's in Europe. So people would sit on this mountain and look down in all the valleys, right, and just look at all the grain that was growing down there. All right, so on represents what? Olfactory, old, optic. Olympus is oculomotor. The T in towering, right, corresponds to the T in trochlear. Now, there are other mnemonics that you can use, right? If this doesn't make a whole lot of sense to you, there are many good mnemonics for cranial nerves. Your book has one. Did anybody write down the one that's in your book? I can't remember what it is, but a lot of students like that one. Or you can go to medicalmnemonics.com, right, and search in there for a mnemonic that makes a lot of sense to you. And you can use them in lab, for instance, or in lecture, but I don't want any X-rated mnemonics, please. All right, so you could put your little parental control in medicalmnemonics.com and just get some nice, sane mnemonics. Huh? Cranial nerves? Ah, okay, well, let's look at some of these. I see there's a question right here. Well, in this mnemonic, we have Finn and German. So here we have facial, vestibulocochlear, and glossopharyngeal, right? That's Finn and German. So the question is, well, why do you have an A right here when the first letter of this nerve is a V? Well, it's not because a V is an upside-down A, but that might be an interesting way of memorizing it. But the name of this cranial nerve number 8 has been simplified, okay, because this is a nerve that goes to your inner ear. And in your inner ear, that is where you have the sense of hearing. So it used to be called the auditory nerve. But that's not all it does. It's also important with balance, so that's a vestibular sense. So that name of that nerve has been simplified over time. Instead of just calling it the auditory nerve, it is now called the vestibulocochlear nerve. Okay? All right, so that's why it has an A. That's just a little historical perspective. All right, vestibulocochlear. The cochlea is responsible for hearing. The vestibular apparatus is responsible for equilibrium. So we'll learn about that when we get into the senses chapter. That's really not for today. Glossopharyngeal. That's an important one for taste. All right, the vagus nerve, number 10. I do want you to know that one specifically for sure, because that's a very important autonomic neuron. It controls a bunch of functions inside your body automatically, and in particular, the heart. And what it does to the heart is that it decreases the heart rate. All right, so the vagus nerve decreases heart rate, and you got to really be familiar with that. Surgeons have to be familiar with that, because if they're digging around inside somebody's body doing surgery to move a tumor or something, and if they accidentally stimulate that nerve, guess what they do? They stop somebody's heart just by stimulating it, right? So you got to know, if you're a surgeon, where that nerve is, and if you have to operate really close to it, then you have to anesthetize it. You have to stop its conduction so that you don't stop somebody's heart by accident. Okay? All right, and hypoglossal, that's just motor to the tongue. All right, so notice, how many of these cranial nerves start with an H?
One.
That's pretty easy to remember. Which one is that? Hop, that's number 12. All right, so once you look at this a couple times, it's not too difficult to memorize this list. And to count them down on the diagram is pretty easy. One last thing. Okay, cranial nerves by function. Here's another mnemonic. All right, S stands for sensory, right? M stands for motor, and B stands for both. All right, so it's a little imperfect because I said, what, afferent, efferent, and mixed? Well, this is a little bit of a change from that. We got sensory, motor, and both for both afferent and efferent. So here is the mnemonic, right? And this, and so there are how many words? There are 12 words corresponding to the 12 cranial nerves, right? So S right here, the first cranial nerve starts with S. So sum, that is a purely afferent nerve. Cranial nerve number 2, purely afferent. So here's the mnemonic. Some say money matters, but my brother says big brains matter most. Okay? Or you could say big bucks matter most or something. Okay? So now that's pretty easy to remember cranial nerves by, whether they're afferent, efferent, or mixed. Okay. All right, so next time we're going to start with spinal nerves. So we're done with cranial nerves. We got just a little bit left to talk about spinal nerves. And here's the sign-in sheet if you need it.